Reading from Sports Illustrated. My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. And let's begin today's reading with a feature from the Sports Illustrated website. Headline reads, 2025 NFL Offseason Winners and Losers. Steelers, Cowboys, and Raiders Improve. Aaron Rodgers, George Pickens, and Geno Smith should give all three teams a boost. Plus, Vikings and Jets show confidence in J.J. McCarthy and Justin Fields. And this feature written by Sports Illustrated writer Gilberto Manzano. As you could see from the many words below, I had plenty to say about the 2025 NFL offseason, which is nearing completion, with mandatory minicamps wrapping up over the next couple of weeks. Several teams had productive off-seasons, using free agency and the draft to improve at various levels. Some of the winners listed below are obvious, but there was one team from the NFC North that drew plenty of praise the past few months that ended up in the other section. But before we get to the winners and losers, I felt compelled to offer explanations for some teams that were not listed in either section. For example, the San Francisco 49ers had a mass player exodus in free agency, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they were losers this offseason. I will explain more in the quote-unquote indifferent section. So, starting off with the winners, Pittsburgh Steelers. The Steelers have gotten overlooked for their productive offseason, partly because they waited for a 41-year-old quarterback who is past his prime. But before we get to Aaron Rodgers, one of many upgrades for this roster, here's a refresher of the Steelers' other notable offseason additions, DK Metcalf, Darius Slay, and rookies Caleb Johnson and Derek Harmon. The Metcalf trade deserves more praise, even with the departure of George Pickens, who wore out his welcome in Pittsburgh and was traded to the Cowboys. Of the two wide receivers, Metcalf is probably the better player because he's a difference maker with or without the ball. The attention that Metcalf drew from opposing defenses contributed to Jackson Smith and Jigba's breakout season in Seattle last year. It could be argued that Pittsburgh is thin at pass catcher. That's where Johnson can help, and the versatile back out of Iowa will also give the Steelers a boost in the running game. Also, free agent wide receivers Amari Cooper and Keenan Allen remain available. If Aaron Rodgers can stay healthy behind an emerging offensive line and replicate his production from last season with the Jets, this Steelers squad might have what it takes to make real noise in the loaded AFC, or at least enough to win their first playoff game in 9 years. This team still has plenty to prove as a potential Super Bowl contender, but there's no question that it got better this off season. Another winner this offseason is the Dallas Cowboys. This might come off as a contradiction because I said the Steelers will be fine without Pickens, but I like the Pickens trade for the Cowboys for many reasons. Dak Prescott has a knack for pushing the ball downfield, and Pickens will see favorable matchups playing next to CeeDee Lamb, who will now likely see more snaps from the slot position. However, this near-perfect Cowboys offseason goes beyond the trade for Pickens. Dallas again prioritized the offensive line with the first-round selection of guard Tyler Booker, the replacement for the recently retired Zach Martin. And the defense could be better with the arrivals of rookies Donovan Isaraku and Shavon Revel Jr. Still, this won't be a perfect offseason until the team knocks down Micah Parsons with a contract extension. Then there are the New England Patriots. The Patriots are a trendy pick as a new playoff team after all of their offseason moves, starting with the hiring of Mike Vrabel. Vrabel wasted no time forming a Patriots squad resembling the physical teams that he assembled in Tennessee. The defense gained an influx of talent, including the splash signing of defensive tackle Milton Williams. The offensive line could be drastically better, a huge plus for the development of Drake May, who showed flashes of being a star quarterback as a rookie last season. Now, if Vrabel can keep Stephon Diggs and Cardi B away from party boats during the season, the Patriots have the pieces to go from very bad to very good in one offseason. And from the Patriots, another team that's listed as a winner here is the New York Giants. If the Giants show substantial improvement, even if the wins don't come, that could be enough for Coach Brian Daboll to keep his job past 2025. This might be a stretch, but Brian Daboll's situation is reminiscent of Kyle Shanahan's early years with the San Francisco 49ers. Even with missing the playoffs three times in 4 years, Shanahan had job security because of his offensive prowess. Many have forgotten about what Daboll did in his first season in New York, taking a bad roster to the divisional round of the postseason. After failing to make it work with Daniel Jones, a quarterback that Daboll inherited, this coaching staff will get to develop first-round selection Jackson Dart, who will start training camp behind Russell Wilson. If Dart shows flashes like May did last season with a bad team, that might be enough to keep Daboll around for another season. Defensively, New York has a loaded defense after adding number 2 pick Abdul Carter and veteran defensive backs Javon Holland and Paulson Adebo. So don't be surprised if the Giants are competitive this season. Next, we look at the Las Vegas Raiders. I almost had the Raiders in the quote-unquote indifferent section below because this roster screams 8 or 9 wins. But then I reminded myself that that's a lot better than what the Silver and Black have done most seasons this century. The trade for Geno Smith gives the Raiders a considerable quarterback upgrade. Maybe Smith will be this team's version of Alex Smith, who helped the Chiefs become competitive before drafting Patrick Mahomes. This franchise hasn't been used to winning in a very long time, and just added a bunch of winners this offseason at critical positions. Coach Pete Carroll, GM John Spytek, and new minority owner Tom Brady are now calling the shots for Mark Davis. And another winner this offseason is J.J. McCarthy. McCarthy being a 2024 first-round pick gives him plenty of status within the organization. However, he still has a lot going against him this offseason as an unproven quarterback on a stacked roster that cannot afford to go through his growing pains. The Vikings could have gone the veteran route by retaining Sam Darnold or signing Rodgers. However, Coach Kevin O'Connell is convinced that J.J. McCarthy is the right quarterback to lead his team, which is a difficult task after returning from a torn meniscus in his right knee. No one within the organization has forgotten about the flashes that McCarthy displayed in his preseason debut against the Raiders before he sustained the season-ending injury. Another potential winner this season is Justin Fields. We should be paying more attention to Fields' supporters with the Bears and the Steelers. Even with his flaws as a passer, that wasn't enough to stop Bears wide receiver DJ Moore from giving Fields a ringing endorsement after it became clear that the team would take a quarterback with the number one pick in 2024. There's also the reporting from Sports Illustrated's Albert Breer on the many people within the Steelers organization who preferred Fields over Wilson last season, and how the team still had interest in Fields before the Jets offered him a contract worth $20 million annually. It says plenty that a team promised Fields a starting job. There is real potential with the 2021 first-round pick, and maybe he's finally ready to put it all together alongside Garrett Wilson and a promising Jets offensive line. It is just hard to believe that the Jets can help him get there. And next, let's look at the losers in the NFL, the Chicago Bears. I have to see it to believe it with the Bears. Yes, they are loaded with skill players and they revamp the offensive line, but that doesn't erase the decades of failure at the quarterback position. Caleb Williams and his dad were well aware of the team's poor track record before the NFL draft and allowed their comments last year to be used to promote a book this year. Drama and dysfunction follow the Bears, but I'm not just assuming the Bears will screw this up because history says they will, including when they were also crowned as winners last offseason. Ben Johnson is a rookie head coach under pressure to deliver fast results in a demanding market. He did himself no favors by saying that he enjoys beating Packers coach Matt LaFleur. I'm all for trash talk, but it seems forced to win press conference points, and he said it knowing that he's not close with LaFleur to be joking around like that. On the field, the Bears are banking on guard Jonah Jackson, who was benched most of last season by the Rams. It was a red flag that the Falcons were okay with letting center Drew Dowman sign with the Chicago, and the Bears might have gotten complacent waiting until late in the second round to draft a tackle. And from Chicago, let's go to Miami and look at the Miami Dolphins. The Dolphins are in a strange position of operating like a rebuilding franchise despite having a quarterback making north of $50 million annually and two wide receivers making nearly $30 million per year apiece. They have injured pass rushers, an inexperienced secondary if they trade Jalen Ramsey, and an offensive line filled with holes. After their aggressive trades didn't pay off in recent seasons, it might be time for the Dolphins to blow up their roster, including trading Tyreek Hill. And from Miami, now let's go to Cincinnati and the Bengals. The Bengals deserve credit for hammering out extensions for Joe Burrow's star receivers, Ja'Marr Chase and T. Higgins. But this team did very little to improve the defense, and there's still the possibility of trading edge rusher Trey Hendrickson, one of Cincinnati's few reliable defensive players. To make matters worse, rookie first-round edge rusher Shamart Stewart hasn't signed all the necessary paperwork to practice, and the team recently cut veteran linebacker Jermaine Pratt. Unless the offense averages 30-plus points per game, this organization might be on the verge of wasting another prime Burrow year. Another potential loser this season is Anthony Richardson. I strongly supported Richardson after many joined in on the Bengals' criticism of him last summer during a joint practice. It's no longer easy to defend Richardson after a dreadful second season. He briefly quit on his team with the infamous helmet tap, making it difficult for coach Shane Steichen to support him. Even after Richardson returned from a brief benching, he didn't display the improvements that fellow 2023 first-rounder Bryce Young has in his with the Panthers. Richardson's work ethic and durability are real concerns, and now he's in danger of starting the season as Daniel Jones' backup after aggravating a shoulder injury earlier this month. Richardson's impressive four starts as a rookie now feel like a fever dream. Next in the loser's bracket, we see New Orleans Saints coach Kellen Moore. The Saints have been tabbed by many as the preseason favorite to land the number one pick in the 2026 NFL draft. First-year coach Kellen Moore got a raw deal after the team decided to commit to Derek Carr for 2025, only for him to retire a few months later. Now, Moore has the daunting challenge of getting second-round rookie Tyler Shough ready to start 17 games for a roster filled with holes. On the bright side, Moore can quickly prove himself as a head coach if he can keep this team competitive. Then among the losers next, we see the Detroit Lions' departures. The Lions were hit hard this offseason, including the departures of coordinators Johnson and Aaron Glenn, as well as the recent retirement of All-Pro center Frank Ragnow. But there were no panic moves from the organization. They calmly leaned on their successful blueprint of building through the trenches. Detroit should be fine on the interior, with Graham Glasnow likely moving back to center between guards Christian Mahogany and Tate Ratledge, who both arrived in the past two drafts. And from Detroit, let's look at the San Francisco 49ers and their player exodus. The 49ers might benefit from the many subtractions that they made this offseason. San Francisco needed to evolve for several reasons, one of which was to become more savvy about the salary cap and Brock Purdy's new massive contract. Clearly, the 49ers' approach to winning the Super Bowl wasn't working. Players were aging, and the production wasn't worth the contracts. Developing a new crop of stars could lead to a quick fix for a team that still has plenty of talent. And from San Francisco, let's next look at the Cleveland Browns and their four-man quarterback competition. The Browns could be very bad this season. And yes, their quarterback options probably wouldn't be in the mix for a starting job anywhere else besides New Orleans. Trying out four quarterbacks and seeing if one sticks isn't the worst approach, considering the massive hole they dug themselves after the embarrassing Deshaun Watson trade and fully guaranteed contract. the shovels are finally out for a rebuild, and perhaps rookies Dylan Gabriel or Shador Sanders will show potential for growth. Or maybe Kenny Pickett will play better after a reset year with the Eagles and away from Pittsburgh. Or maybe they will zombie walk most of 2025 with middle-aged Joe Flacco. That scenario could be the best for this franchise if it ends up with the top pick in next year's draft. And let's not forget that they own the Jaguars' 2026 first-round pick thanks to the Travis Hunter trade. And again, that feature from Sports Illustrated's website is entitled 2025 NFL Offseason Winners and Losers. Steelers, Cowboys, and Raiders Improve. Written by Sports Illustrated writer Gilberto Manzano. And from NFL news, let's turn now to some WNBA news. Here's a special feature here entitled Denise Long Reif. Nearly 50 years ago, a high school sharpshooter from Iowa became the first woman to be drafted by an NBA team. And this special feature written by Sports Illustrated writer Greg Bishop. Denise Long lived on Irwin Street in her speck of a hometown. It was the summer of 1967, and the view from her bedroom window presented the general store, the post office, and a hangout for teenagers, the Sugar Shack. She could almost see the entirety of Witten, Iowa, population almost 200. Oh, did she love that hangout. The only thing she loved more was basketball. The 5'11" forward scored and scored and never stopped scoring, as if she were put on this planet for that purpose only. Sometimes she combined those loves, entering the Sugar Shack with a basketball tucked under her right arm. One day that same summer, a friend asked to speak to her outside. His name was Rex, she says on the phone from her home in Kansas. Nearly six decades later, she is Denise Long Reif now. She is reliving a magical period of her life that became part of sports history. Back to the story. They stopped out front near the entrance of the Sugar Shack. He looked down at her, his face becoming serious. Denise, he said, you're going to have to stop being so crazy about basketball. You need to think about your future and how you're going to create some wealth. There's no future in girls' basketball, and I just want to tell you right now that you act like the Boston Celtics or the Los Angeles Lakers are going to draft you. You're not going to be drafted by an NBA team. You might as well forget it, unquote. And her response? Denise says, I don't even know who those teams are. Some 20 months and a few thousand points scored later, Long Reif went to the principal's office at Union Witten High School one May afternoon. She wanted some construction paper to make a bulletin board posting. She ran into a friend named Dennis there. The boy started laughing. When she asked what was so funny, he responded, well, you've been drafted. And she says, I figured that I was drafted by the Army. And he says, no, you've been drafted by the San Francisco Warriors. She didn't know of that NBA franchise either, but she sure did remember that conversation outside the Sugar Shack. Long Reif played basketball in an era far distant from the modern WNBA. In the late 1960s, female hoopsters played 6-on-6 with three guards set up on one side of the court to defend and three forwards set up on the opposite end to score. They could only dribble twice before they had to shoot or pass. In many respects, this version of basketball naturally lifted some of the game's best aspects: movement, precision passing, and, of course, offenses that could score almost at will. To become the scorer among all scorers, Longreif decided on a singular strategic approach. Quote, "If I'm only going to get two dribbles, I'm going to make sure that I could score from any place on the court, which I did." Unquote. "Describe the shots involved, please," we asked. Quote, "I developed a very good right-handed hook shot and a very good left-handed hook shot. I was good at long shots, and then I developed a drop-step jumper. My first two seasons, I didn't really have a jump shot." Unquote. "You must have annihilated all the fools who dare to challenge you in horse, no?" Quote, "I beat Sam Jones in two games of horse." Unquote. As Longreif describes it, she felled the five-time NBA All-Star by positioning her body behind the basket, leaning back and banking in shots from the left side of the goal. "He couldn't do it," she said. "So you really had an underhand bank shot?" "I had two," she replies. "You had to be creative on 6-on-6. Quote, "I used to have what I called a screw shot. I'd be right underneath the basket, and I would twist the shot with my hand, and the guards couldn't really get to it because I wouldn't extend my arms out. I would keep the ball close to the right side of my chest, and I would take the ball and, quote-unquote, screw it, and it would hit the backboard and go in." Unquote. In high school, Longreif scored 6,250 points, which was a national record back then. The three-point shot did not yet exist. Her mark would not be broken for 18 years. She shot Union Witten to the state title in her junior year. That season's championship game, viewed on TV by 3.5 million people across the Midwest, can still be found on YouTube. And while most consider her 64 points in that triumph as a seminal moment in her basketball legend, emblematic of her point-scoring prowess, Longreif never exactly saw it that way. Quote, "Not trying to use false humility or anything, but that really wasn't one of my better games." Unquote. She surpassed 100 points in three separate games, including one in which she scored 111. Her coach had removed her from a blowout with 3 minutes 49 seconds left in the fourth quarter, believing Longreif had amassed 112 points, a state record at the time. In the locker room that night, her coach, the opposing coach, and the official scorer grilled Longreif about the number of free throws she had shot. Her cousin, a teammate, remembered 5. Her coach still has the scorebook, though, and both the coach and Longreif have maintained that it shows 6 made attempts. That night, her coach asked, "Why are you doing this to her?" And the scorekeeper said that they shouldn't have run up the score. "What do you mean, run up the score?" her coach said. "I can't help it if she's good." To which Longreif said, quote, "But their record book was the official one. How many points could I have gotten if I stayed in for that other 3 minutes and 59 seconds? I may not have been quite 16 yet, and that's not a very nice thing to do." Unquote. Longreif recalls another moment from that summer of 1967. Outside, shooting baskets with a friend, they took a break, settling under an elm tree. The friend began to marvel. "Wouldn't it be great if you could get on the Johnny Carson show and tell everybody about girls' basketball?" To which Longreif responded, "Cindy, that's not going to happen." 2 years later, she was drafted, and not by the Army, by the NBA. Long Rife said, quote, "I had one question. Do I have to go?" Unquote. Well, yes, sort of. Maybe. Franklin Mealy worked as a radio and a TV producer in San Francisco. He knew how to tell a story that would resonate. He also owned the Warriors. His selection of Long Rife in the 13th round is often framed as little more than a publicity stunt. It was that, but it was more than that. Perhaps Mealy knew that NBA Commissioner Walter Kennedy would never allow the selection. And Kennedy did veto the pick on the grounds that the league did not draft high school players. Still, Mealy and Long Rife made history. Since then, only one other woman has been drafted by an NBA team. Lucia Harris in 1977, drafted by the Jazz. She declined to try out. Mealy brought Long Rife to California, where, lo and behold, she did appear on The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson just over a week after she was drafted. The show also featured Jack Dempsey and Gene Tunney, two elite heavyweight boxers known for their long count fight back in 1927. Long Rife said, quote, "I had Jack Dempsey on my left and Gene Tunney on my right in this monitor room. They were debating who really won that fight. Dempsey tried to get my dad to be a prize fighter, and Dad said, 'No, I'm too pretty, and my wife might divorce me.' He signed a $2 bill for my father," unquote. Mealy had a plan. Flying Long Rife to San Francisco was not a quote-unquote trip of any sort, nor was the player written off as a publicity stunt lacking in skill, magnetism, or accomplishments. Long Rife had more of all three than any female player in America. Mealy wanted her to live in the Bay Area as part of a new venture he created. Mealy agreed to pay for Long Rife's college tuition if she played in his four-team women's professional hoops undertaking. He named it the Warrior Girls Basketball League. Their games took place before Warriors' home contests. Long Rife became the centerpiece of his efforts. Mealy gave her $5,000 for expenses and leased her a purple Jaguar to drive. No player received a salary. While in San Francisco, Long Rife also met the Giants' Willie McCovey at a photo shoot. She remembers leaning on a bat, looking up at the future Hall of Famer as if she worshipped him. His head was thrown way back, and he was laughing. Long Rife said, quote, "And I also got to interact with Willie Mays, too. I just took his hat off his head and put it on, and Willie Mays said back to me, 'Well, now that you got my hat, I'm going to teach you how to bat,'" unquote. "And where's the hat now?" we asked. She responded, "I made a big mistake. I gave it back to him." Around this time, she met Will Chamberlain, too. Long Rife asked for his signature, to which he responded, "I should be getting your autograph," unquote. After one game, Mealy took Long Rife and her sister to a local bar where Wilt the Stilt liked to hang out. He was Long Rife's favorite player, so unlike everyone else in his sport, not unlike, well, her. Quote, "We would go over and play the jukebox. We didn't want to miss him. I had kept my suit on because I'd played a game before the Warriors game. So I was leaning over to pick out some songs, and I felt ice cubes go down my top. And I turn around and I put my hand up. And Wilt Chamberlain blocked my hand, and he said, 'I can block your shot anytime,'" unquote. the experiment that Muley masterminded folded after just 1 year. Longrife went back to Iowa, where she attended Marshalltown Community College. One day, a man named Paul approached her and told her that he had heard that she had taken up quote-unquote dancing. He didn't mean square. An exotic dancer nearby had been using her name as a stage name. Paul took her right over there. Longrife asked the dancer to stop. The dancer cited higher tips as the reason that she would continue to appropriate the significance behind what Denise's name had come to mean. Longrife's mother told her that her father had already paid the establishment a visit while she was in California. He told the bartender at the club that this stage name better cease, slamming a fist on the bar for emphasis. Longrife said, quote, "I was so depressed over it. I was walking into my house, and we had a Bible beneath the TV on a shelf, and I noticed there was something sticking out of it," unquote. It was a Bible verse about God and belief and unwavering faith. She brought her Bible to school with her the next day when, in a common area, a group of four female students noticed her and it. They approached and asked, "Aren't you Denise Long?" "Well, yes." "Are you a Christian?" "Well, maybe." They promised that a quadriplegic man would visit her house soon, and he did. He could drive with a modified vehicle. He could read, turning pages with a device attached to his mouth. He quoted verses from the Bible and told her that with God, she could do anything that she wanted. Taking that as a sign, Longrife left Iowa again to play for a Christian team that would barnstorm throughout Asia in the early 1970s. At halftime, they would sing gospel songs to the crowd. Longrife said, quote, "We won 10 out of 22 games or something like that. Not bad. We memorized their languages by phonetics, and we would give our testimony in Chinese," unquote. After that tour end, Longrife returned home to Iowa once more. She often attended the high school state championship game, but schools had begun playing 5-on-5, which she did not prefer. Longrife had earned 2 degrees by then, the first in physical education, the second in theology. Bored and in the need of a profession that wasn't on the fringes of the basketball world, she eventually became a pharmacist, graduating from her training in 1995. The pharmacy, she found, could grow tedious when not busy. Then she became aware of a new women's basketball league, the WNBA. Watching games helped her pass the downtime. "What did you think?" we asked her. Quote, "I was amazed. I just couldn't believe they were getting so good. The girls are really fun to watch. I mean, Caitlin Clark is really phenomenal," unquote. "When did you first become aware of her?" Longrife sighs over the phone. "Later than most," she says. She liked to visit a Baptist church in Des Moines, where someone asked what she made of Clark. Longrife had no idea who that was. "You really haven't heard of Caitlin Clark?" "Nope, she hadn't. Who was she?" And she says, "Well, she's really, really good. And I found out that she is from Iowa, and I did watch a bunch of her games right after that. She's just really out of this world." Caitlin Clark and I have totally different personalities. She is gregarious. Sometimes she'll put both her hands out to the crowd as if to say, "Did you see that? I was under such an autocratic coach. If I did that, I'd be on the bench," unquote. The WNBA's expansion efforts begin in full force this season in a place familiar to Long Rife, San Francisco, with the Golden State Valkyries. The same organization that drafted her now has a counterpart in a professional women's league, one that helped her endure the boredom baked into being a small-town pharmacist. The WNBA is growing, and no one has driven that more than another sharpshooter from Iowa. Caitlin Clark and Long Rife played in different eras. Nobody, man or woman, was draining shots from the logo in 1969. Clark does it now as proficiently and regularly as any NBA cager. Long Rife says of Caitlin Clark, quote, "She had, I don't know how else to put it, advance notice of what the game was going to be like. She has a three-point shot, dribbles very well, goes behind the back and goes the other way. I think she'd fare better in the NBA than I would have back then," unquote. She adores Caitlin Clark and so many other players. Long Rife, once the subject of headlines like, quote, "Denise Long, the cutest warrior of them all," unquote, also believes that Caitlin Clark has handled the outsized attention far better than she did. Quote, "I was more nervous when I played. She doesn't have that personality. She's carefree and confident," unquote. Long Rife retired around the year 2016. She had her right hip replaced, had her left knee replaced, had her left hip replaced, underwent quadruple bypass surgery. Each procedure, at least in some way, marked basketball's imprint on her. These days, she cannot jog. She cannot twist her left leg. But she will occasionally still pop by the local rec center where she lives in Rose Hill outside of Wichita and hoist a few attempts towards the rim. No threes, no floaters, just like those good old days when she left her imprint, still sizable, on the sport of basketball. And again, that feature is entitled Denise Long Rife. Nearly 50 years ago, a high school sharpshooter from Iowa became the first woman to be drafted by an NBA team, written by Sports Illustrated writer Greg Bishop. And as Father's Day approaches, here's a short feature entitled Dad Strength. Admittedly, it's early to be handicapping baseball's MVP races, but in the first month of the season, the front runner for the National League Award was Fernando Tatis Jr. The outfielder had a league-high 8 home runs in the San Diego Padres' first 24 games and was a big reason that the team was tied for the best start in baseball. The 26-year-old was also batting .344. Again, it's early, but that would by far be the best of his six-year career. On a podcast in April, Tatis said that his hot start was inspired in part by an off-season conversation with his father, former big leaguer Fernando Tatis Sr. Quote, "My dad asked me if I was a good hitter. I told him, yeah," Tatis said. "And he told me, no, because you never hit 300 consistently," unquote. As Father's Day approaches, it's worth noting that Tatis is one of several second-generation players making noise this season. Vladimir Guerrero Jr., for example, signed a $500 million extension with the Blue Jays. There are father-son connections in every sport, but they're especially strong in baseball. As Tatis has learned, father knows best, even though Tatis Sr. never hit 300 in his 11 seasons. And again, that short feature is entitled Dad Strength. And staying with baseball, here's a feature entitled Major League All-Star Game Voting Roundtable, Potential Debuts, Close Races, and Pitcher Picks. Fan voting for next month's All-Star Game in Atlanta opened on Wednesday. Let's tackle some hot topics on the ballot and beyond. Topic 1, make the case for someone to make their All-Star Game debut. Sports Illustrated writer Tom Verducci takes this topic and says, the easy pick here is Pete Crow Armstrong of the Chicago Cubs, one of the major breakout stars of the season. I'll go with a slightly less obvious pick, James Wood of the Washington Nationals. In the National League OPS, he trails only Freddie Freeman, Shohei Ohtani, and Kyle Schwarber. He also is top five in the league in home runs, RBIs, and total bases. He hits lefties, he's a 305 hitter with runners in scoring position, and he absolutely mashes fastballs with his easy off-field power. And fellow Sports Illustrated writer Stephanie Abstein replies, it has to be Cal Raleigh, right? He's on pace for the greatest season of all time by a catcher. Raleigh has played in every game for the Seattle Mariners this season. He leads the league in dingers, and it doesn't appear to be slowing down. Sign him up for the home run derby while we're at it. Sports Illustrated's Ryan Phillips adds, quote, the Chicago White Sox aren't as bad as they were last year, but they are still terrible. Despite that, they need an all-star, and it is not easy to find one on their roster. Enter rookie righty Shane Smith. A Rule 5 pick this year, he's 2 wins, 3 losses, with a 2.45 ERA and 60 strikeouts against 25 walks in 62 innings. He also leads the team with a 1.7 WAR, making him an easy pick as their lone participant. And he's a former undrafted free agent, so this is a great story to boot. Next question. The National League outfield race is especially crowded. Which three deserve most to start in the All-Star game? And Tom Verducci replies, the future is now. How about this outfield when it comes to youth and athleticism? Crow Armstrong, age 23, Wood, age 22, and Corbin Carroll, age 24. No offense to Fernando Tatis Jr. and Kyle Tucker, but those three rank 1-2-3 in some order in slugging and total bases among National League outfielders. And Stephanie Abstein says, I think that Crow Armstrong is a lock here, and I expect that San Diego Padres fans will vote in force for Tatis, which is very reasonable. Carroll makes a good case, as does Tucker, but I think for me the third spot in the outfield goes to Wood. The light tower power, the poise at age 22, and the fact that he was asked to replace Juan Soto and then basically did just that. This guy is incredible. And the next question, who is your current pick to start at shortstop for the American League in the All-Star Game? Bobby Witt Jr., Jeremy Pena, or Jacob Wilson? Tom Verducci replies, you can never go wrong with Bobby Witt Jr., but I am fascinated by Jacob Wilson, a 363 hitter with his 86 hits and 16 strikeouts. He could join Placido Polanco as the only right-handed hitters in the past 50 years to get 200 hits with less than 40 strikeouts. He also leads American League shortstops in OPS. Stephanie Abstein's reply is, it's really close, but I'll go with Jeremy Pena. It's probably not fair to call his last two seasons disappointing, but after his outrageous postseason in his rookie year, he's only been about average as a hitter. The chance to hit leadoff this year seems to have unlocked something in Peña, who has statistically been the fourth best offensive player in the American League. He's also a stellar defender, although that's not always been true, unquote. Next question. Last year, four rookies, Paul Skeens, Jackson Merrill, Shota Imanaga, and Mason Miller, were named All-Stars. Do any rookies deserve selections this year? And if so, who? Tom Verducci replies, Shane Smith of the Chicago White Sox deserves consideration. Chad Patrick of the Brewers and 35-year-old Tomioko Sugano of the Orioles bear watching. And I like catcher Drake Baldwin of the Braves, but don't see enough volume at this point. And finally, though the fans don't vote for pitchers, who would be your picks as the starting pitchers? And Tom Verducci replies, Garrett Crochet of Boston and Skeens of Pittsburgh. The American League call is a difficult one. Chris Bubich of the Royals, Hunter Brown of the Astros, and Max Fried of the Yankees all have sub-2 ERAs, but I'll go with Crochet with an ERA of 1.92, who also leads the league in innings and strikeouts. The National League starter is obvious. Skeens should get his second All-Star start in as many seasons. Skeens is the Pedro Martinez of this generation, the best put-away pitcher in baseball because he has so many options to finish hitters. He has thrown 410 pitches this year with two strikes and has given up only 14 hits and a .082 batting average. How good is that? The lowest recorded average allowed with two strikes by a pitcher with at least 25 starts is .080 by Hideo Nomo back in 1995. And Stephanie Abstein replies to this question with, Tarek Skubal and Logan Webb would be fun, in part because they're ranked numbers 1 and 2, respectively, in fan graphs, and also because they are just so stylistically different. Skubal throws a billion miles an hour and tries to strike everybody out, while Webb directs his sinker into hitters' bat paths and makes them roll over to the infield. It would be a nice reminder that there are still a lot of ways to get outs. And Sports Illustrated writer Nick Selby replies, Skubal gets this ball for the American League. The reigning Cy Young Award winner has the league's best strikeout rate, walk rate, and whip. For the National League, give me Logan Webb, who's put up a 2.55 ERA and a Major League leading 2.14 FIP over a National League leading 81 innings. There's a not-so-short list of other players putting up ace-like numbers, so expect them to jockey for position over the next few weeks to make this a tight race. And Ryan Phillips answers, Skeens is a no-brainer to start for the National League. The American League crowd is a lot tighter. I would pick Royals lefty Bubik and his 1.43 ERA over Brown and Crochet, but it is incredibly close to me. And Will Laws replies, Skubal is on pace to be the first qualified pitcher in history to average more than 11 strikeouts and less than one walk per nine innings. While Skeens leads National League pitchers in win probability, batting average against, and whip, and ranks second in both ERA and FIP. This matchup would be a clash of titans for two innings anyway. And again, That feature is entitled Major League Baseball All-Star Game Voting Roundtable, Potential Debuts, Close Races, and Pitcher Picks. And now let's turn to Faces in the Crowd by Dan Falkenheim of Sports Illustrated. Here's a name, Braden Berries. His sport is basketball, and his hometown is San Bernardino, California. Berries, a 6'4" combo guard for Eleanor Roosevelt High, had 44 points, 12 rebounds, 3 blocks, 2 steals, and 2 assists in an 80-60 CIF Open Division Championship win over Archbishop Riordan High School in San Francisco, breaking the Open Division Finals scoring record. An Arizona commit, the McDonald's All-American averaged 29.7 points and 8.8 rebounds and shot 56% from the field in 35 games this season. And that's all the time that we have for this reading of Sports Illustrated. Again, my name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. Have a great day. My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for tuning in to this week's edition of Sports Illustrated. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info. And you could hear Sun Sounds on your smart home device.